Fuck me like you mean it. Come on.
Welcome home.
From Slightly Unbalanced, we are still queer as folk. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Today we're talking about episode 1 of season 5, and it's called Move and Leave.
It first aired in the U.S. on May 22nd, 2005, and that was 10 months after the season 4 finale. It was written by showrunners Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman, and they wrote the season 4 finale, too.
Move and Leave was directed by Kelly Macon, his 8th of 11 episodes. He directed last season's Irritation and Separation episode that we unanimously loved. He also directed the season 4 finale, which we unanimously hated. I think we hated it. Didn't we hate it?
Yes. Yeah, we were not fans. It's very up and down with season 4.
Yeah.
Here's the synopsis for Move and Leave. Michael takes it upon himself to throw a 10-year anniversary surprise party for Melanie and Lindsay, who proceed to air all their dirty laundry in front of 25 guests.
That was great.
Who saw that coming? I think everyone did.
I loved it.
Ben and Michael decide it's time to leave Liberty Avenue and buy a house of their own next to two other gay couples with children.
Justin is still in Hollywood, but Brian cancels his trip to see him for reasons that we can't quite figure out. It ends up not mattering, though, because the studio pulls the plug on Rage, and Justin will be heading back to Pittsburgh in the next episode. In a hilarious runner, Debbie and Carl walk in on Emmett being plowed by somebody named Sean, causing him to start looking for his own place. In a not-so-hilarious runner, Ted meets a twink that tries to force-feed him pizza. There's a lot going on in this episode.
Oh, my.
So it's moving day in Pittsburgh. Lindsay moved out. Ben and Michael are thinking of moving out. Carl is moving in with Debbie. Emmett is moving out from Debbie's. And Justin has moved to L.A., but will soon be moving back to Pittsburgh. Brian and Ted are the only major characters not moving.
Yes, the stasis, finally. There's just a whole bunch of, like, shuffle that happens.
Interestingly enough, this episode had the second lowest rating of the season, but I thought it was pretty good. I didn't mind this episode so much.
Yeah, and well, especially after the season 4 finale, I was not mad at this episode at all.
So the A story was a little confusing because it had not one, not two, but four characters that kind of wove in and out of the story. And so I grouped Melanie and Lindsay and Ben and Michael together into one story because I think the notion of Ben and Michael wanting to move out and buy a place was really the causality of Melanie and Lindsay breaking up. And so I married these two together. So let's talk about all four people at once. This is like the deluxe A story.
Okay. I'm ready.
So this theme actually of these four characters is going to carry on for several more episodes. And I'm kind of a fan of this story, so I don't mind so much going on. Picking up where we left off last season, the charade continues between Melanie and Lindsay. And I'm still digging this secret breakup story. We just know that Michael is going to explode when he finds out. And the writers keep adding on to that. It's a really clever way to build up all this dramatic tension between Michael and the lesbians. We know that Michael just is going to go through the roof when he finds out.
Yeah, he goes from 0 to 100 very easily. And I also just think like how horrible this is for both Lindsay and Melanie too, that they have to somehow pile on to the lie to keep it going until they feel like it's, then it'll be okay for us to tell them. And I'm like, well, it's never going to be an okay time to tell people because then they're going to do what happens later on, which is like, you had the secret the whole time. You didn't feel like you could trust us, all that stuff. And it's like, you know, just mentally, that's not going to do you any good. So why continue to play up this charade?
There was good causality behind that we find out later in the big reveal. We'll talk about that in a second. Michael and Ben have some pretty cool neighbors, if I must say. I love seeing Ben and Michael in that dad mode with Hunter when they were scolding him for stopping by the neighbor's party.
Excuse us.
What are they giving me a look for? This isn't a fucking back room.
That party has been going on since last night.
Lock yourself in the bathroom.
Michael.
Just curious.
Bags packed to the rafters. One of them looks just like...
Hey, dudes, you're home.
Why aren't you?
Jason and Troy asked me if we had the new Christina Aguilera CD, so I loaned them this.
That'll be the last we see of that. Thank you very much.
You don't belong over there with guys who've been partying all night.
I was just trying to be neighborly and maybe cop a little weed.
You should be studying for your midterms.
Crack those books, pal.
The scolding is just, I think, a little too harsh. And I think it's just, first of all, I love that visual of Michael carrying that giant ass giraffe into the hallway. But also, I had no idea they lived, that Babylon was literally their next door neighbor. I was like, these guys are pouring in and out of that apartment and just making out and going at it in the hallway. I'm like, hi, this is still a residence.
I thought it was weird that Ben says, what is this, Homo Central? Yeah. It is.
Yeah. You live in the gay neighborhood.
Well, even with the door closed, you could still hear the bass coming through.
The thumpa thumpa.
Yes. I've got a note about that term later on. I used to have neighbors like that when I lived in Boys Town, and it was actually kind of a lot of fun. They always had something going on, and I would love to just stop by.
Yeah, but I also like to sleep.
Good point.
That's why, like, when I lived near Boys Town, it was always, I attributed it to being close enough to where I could go out and have a good time, but far enough to leave it there.
I loved living in Boys Town. If Boys Town hadn't have changed quite so much, I would still live there. But like the neighborhood changed, even the bars
there
are
has
changing.
There has been an evolution of Boys Town.
Yeah.
Somewhat.
On the other side of Boys Town, we are introduced to two new characters called Eli and Monty.
I'm Devin's biological father, and Monty is Ondine's bio dad. Same mom, however. It was important to us that they be related.
Finally got the kids down. I had to sing Under the Sea 6 times.
Oh. You do perform it brilliantly.
Your kids are so adorable.
Yeah.
Thanks. Eli tells me you just had one of your own.
Jenny Rebecca, but we call her JR.
I love that.
But we're not parenting like you.
No, Melanie and Lindsay are lesbian friends of the primary parents.
Well, if you ever do decide to raise one of your own, this is a perfect neighborhood to do it. We have a huge backyard.
It's gymboree down the block.
And they're even putting in a baby gap.
And at first I thought it was Blaine and Blair from season 2's episode where Emmett is the naked maid.
Oh, right. But these guys are younger. So is it that one of them works with Ben? I've been trying to
figure out. I don't know.
How do they know each other?
They were talking about the English department. So maybe you're right. It just went over my head.
Yeah, that's where I thought, like, oh, I guess he's a coworker of Ben. But also, just all of a sudden, they're over this people's place. And I'm like, first of all, yeah, they do look very well off.
Well, we're regaled with stereotypical comments about gays foraging into a shitty neighborhood and fixing it up.
It's funny. When I was a kid, we weren't even allowed to come over here. It was too dangerous.
Now the only danger is if they run out of wasabi peas at Whole Foods.
Leave it to the queers to turn dross into gold.
That's no fairy tale. Ever since the gays moved in, started fixing things up, real estate prices have soared.
Was that really ever like a big thing, though? I mean, did like all the gays move at once into a shitty neighborhood and fix it up?
It's not so much that it's the gays, but it's definitely a product of gentrification. And I guess sometimes gays are a part of that. I mean...
Well, if the gays did it in Boys Town, Chicago, all it did was like drive them out of the neighborhood because they couldn't afford it anymore.
Oh, that's true. That's like, I would say 80% of why I don't want to ever live in Boys Town is because it's far too expensive.
This scene contrasting the parochial neighborhood with Liberty Avenue after they left Monty and Eli's house I thought it was strange. I think I'm definitely more of the Liberty Avenue type.
See, I feel like I would want to split the difference. Like, I like the idea of being able to go home and it's kind of quiet when I want to, but I also like being close enough to like, okay, I'm okay with having a good time like out right now. So let me go there. Something that splits the difference would make me very happy.
Strictly speaking, Ben and Michael don't actually live on Liberty Avenue. They live off of the Rue de Liberté. So I thought this was kind of an interesting way to convince Ben that he really hates this apartment.
Yeah, it feels like he almost turned on a dime.
We get lots of sight gags about the apartment being too small. Like, Emmett comes over. They try to all fit in the kitchen at once. It's like, yes, we know. It's a small apartment. But it's not that small. It's like a two-bedroom apartment. That's a fair amount of space, right?
Yeah. I mean, it almost reads like a New York apartment. And that, yeah, the kitchens are typically very small, but you can find, you know, so a surprising amount of living space if you're smart. And I mean, they have a very spacious apartment for a 2-bedroom, and 3 people are living there. So it felt like they may have actually built a smaller kitchen and put that into the set to sell that point. Because I'm like, y'all never complained before.
Something that caught my attention is that Michael is the one that's initially reluctant to buy the house.
Buying a house is not like buying a CD or a sweater. Even if we did decide to do it, first we'd have to review our finances, check out the numbers, right, Em?
Oh, I'd say checking out the numbers is essential.
But he had no problem buying a comic shop spontaneously, and he did embrace that entire parochial lifestyle with Dr. David Cameron. So he kind of flip-flopped on this. He's done these really spontaneous things in the past, and he has enjoyed living in the countryside with Dr. David Cameron.
Well, the difference with the Dr. David Cameron situation was that that was all provided for. He was not buying into it at all.
That's a good point.
Here, yeah.
He was a cupped boy.
Exactly. So here, when it's been and they have like shared finances, and all of a sudden Michael is like super fiscally conservative and like super responsible, allegedly, doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
So this surprise party that Michael decided to throw, a question here for you.
Go ahead.
Is it good form to throw a surprise party in somebody's house right after they have a baby? Like, is that the time to bring 25 people over and say, hi, we're coming in?
No.
Exactly.
I was so... Okay.
If you even know if they were home, right?
Exactly. Like this is a problem. Like, first of all, how do you know that they were available to do so? How did you know that it was going to be okay when they literally have like a week's old infant to bring in a bunch of people to celebrate this marriage or this, you know, this couple? And how dare you think that it was all right to bring all of these people? And At first I thought it was just like our core cast, but no, it was a huge group of people. I would have been livid.
Yeah,
if that
exactly.
happened. I was like, especially like we know how stressed Mel has been trying to take care of JR herself. So like now to say, okay, oh yeah, I'm going to bring in these 30 people and we're going to like totally party down your house and we'll worry about the mess later. Wow, Michael.
It worked for the awkwardness of the scene, but at the same time, I think there's ways that they could have executed this in a different way and achieved the same result. They didn't have to have the surprise portion and they didn't have to have that big, oh, quick, Lindsay, get over here. 25 of our friends are here. There's ways that this party could have happened and still had the big blow up, the big reveal of what was really going on.
Seriously, like in my head, I would have been like, hi, you all need a break. Let's get a babysitter for the night. We're going to treat you out, just the four of us. Okay, say it's a double date.
Yeah.
That's how you then get the two of them together away from the house to a different location and then have the surprise party, and you can still have the situation that we had.
Historically, these parties have been thrown at Brian's loft, by the way. Mm-hmm. We've had a few of those.
Because wide open spaces.
Exactly. So the big reveal, and wow. What a reveal this was. All of it comes right out. It's just thrown out in front of so many people, and I loved it.
Thank you for all your good wishes. But you see, Melanie and I are having some problems.
I wasn't having any problems. I was trying to have a baby.
All right, I'm the one responsible for all the problems.
Damn right you are.
For which I've apologized endlessly. But you still refuse to accept the fact that
fucking Sam Auerbach had nothing to do with sex? It was all about art, all the humping was about form and function.
The truth is, we haven't been living together since our daughter was born.
Seeing Melanie come right out and say that Lindsay fucks Sam was harsh, unrestrained, it was great.
It shows how much Melanie loves to just react. There's no nuance to her revealing anything or trying to keep things private between what should just be between her and Lindsay. She's still allowing herself to get her barbs in. And boy, does she stab deep.
I was waiting for this for quite some time. In past episodes, I had talked about how much I liked this "we know something you don't know" type of thing. And the tension that was building up over those episodes was great. I finally had a payoff. I was excited. Good writing.
Oh my gosh. And it's just like, I almost wanted to be like the way you fuck Sam Auerbach, cut to everyone going like, oh, and then like next scene, like just let it hang there.
Yeah. String it out throughout the whole episode. Right.
Oh my God.
So it got a little weird though, when all of a sudden all the guests are gone. Ben and Michael are having this conversation with Lindsay and Melanie. And this seemed a little weird because, okay, sure, you blew up and told everybody in the room what was going on. But after the fact, isn't this sort of a mind your own business type of thing with Michael and Ben?
I had enough to deal with without having to explain to everyone.
Look, you've been having personal problems. We understand.
No, we do not understand. How could you not say a word all this time? So when were you going to tell me? After she grew up and went to college and got married and had children of her own? I have seen you practically every day since Jenny was born, and it's always been so sweet, so adorable. The two doting mothers. Well, who would have guessed it was a big fucking lie?
When I agreed to be the baby's father, it's because I knew she would be raised in a loving home with two loving parents, not in some sort of time-sharing arrangement with complimentary sniping. Now, you can make all the excuses you want, but if this is how you plan on raising our daughter, then we should never have had her in the first place.
Normal people would say yes, but this is Michael we're talking about. So, of course, he wants to make sure that it is just as much about him as it is about this couple that is clearly having seen a 10-year relationship come to an end. And instead of truly being there for the two of them, it's more about, how is this affecting me? And I'm like, Michael, you trying to say that this is about JR is like makes no sense. Like it feels like JR is just a ploy for you to complain about how this is hurting you.
Yeah, I mean, sure, he's the father of the child, but I don't think that gives him any kind of right to be part of their decision to split up or to like even be consulted on it. Because after all, there was no agreement because due to Melanie's bad lawyering.
Right, exactly. Yes.
They had the agreement. She ripped it up. This all could have been avoided.
Right. It almost, well, I know I could have sworn he actually signed something.
No, he didn't.
He didn't sign something when he agreed to be the donor.
Initially, Melanie put a multi-page contract in front of him.
Yes.
And then he was like, wait, I thought I was going to be the father and be involved, blah, 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 blah. And Melanie dramatically ripped up the contract in front of him.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Thank you. I made a comment on this podcast at the time about, gee, that was a big dumb move there, Melanie. You'll find out later.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. It's amazing how terrible she is at being a lawyer, even though she touts to being one hell of a lawyer.
I don't think it was the wrong decision to not tell Michael or Ben or anybody. I mean, they need to do that on their own time. Sure, they should tell people eventually, but this was kind of provoked. They were like provoked into disclosing it. There was like, well, okay, everybody's here. Might as well tell them now. But I don't think they're like obligated to tell him just yet.
No, I mean, for all we know, they probably wanted to wait until they had everything absolutely sorted, that both children were taken care of properly, that Lindsay was absolutely settled down and was able to, you know, financially support herself and her portions of taking care of Gus and JR, as well as Melanie, even though, you know, Melanie has just had the baby. So she's probably not going back to being a lawyer just yet.
If she ever was.
And then... And then, you know, say, okay, know that this is what has happened. We have ended the relationship and we're not going to go into why, but we decided that it is no longer a viable thing, whatever they needed to say. Now, granted, Michael still would have gone through the roof and still would have been upset because I bet he feels like it's just his parents divorcing again or his parents splitting up in some way. It's like,
it's funny you say that, Michael. Because I struggled through the whole episode to understand why he became so unhinged and said some of the things he did, like we shouldn't have had her in the first place. That's just not helpful.
Yeah, this whole...
You did have her. They split up. You need to find a path forward.
Exactly. Would he have said that if they split up, like, say, 5 years down the road when she's, you know, not necessarily a weeks old baby, but she is like... A young, even an infant or even a toddler or whatever, like, would he have had that same kind of reaction to it? What if they split up when she was 18? We should have never have had her. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Tell her that.
Right. I would have been like right here going like, what the fuck, dude?
Exactly. The thing that I didn't like about Michael's behavior is that, like you were saying, it was all about himself. It was kind of cloaked under, this is all about Jenny Rebecca. I just didn't get that feeling from watching this episode, though.
No, I didn't. I didn't. Not for a second. Especially when, you know, he eventually is having that conversation with Brian. And something that really stuck out to me, because Brian like lets it slip that he, that first he had Lindsay like talking about how it was the end of the relationship and her crying about it. And now I have you. And he's all like, wait a minute, you knew and you never told me? Well, first of all, it's not his to tell, which Brian tells him. And then the fact that Michael says your loyalty to Lindsay is more important than our friendship. I was like, so you're asking Brian to make sure that you are more important than Lindsay is.
Wait a minute. You're telling me you knew about this and you didn't tell me?
She asked me not to.
So your loyalty to her was more important than our friendship.
Don't make this about us, Michael, because it's not.
So the aftermath of that discussion with our four characters, we get some clarity on something that I kept tripping up on over several episodes, and that's that Melanie didn't really want this to end. She didn't want people to know because it would make it real.
It had to be done. We had to tell them.
It's just that...
What?
Telling them. Seeing their faces. Knowing they know. Somehow makes it real.
And I thought that was some really classy writing there. It was made even more classy that Lindsay just turns around and leaves when she hears Melanie say that. I thought that was a great scene.
Because then I think it actually offers the emotional weight that I think I've been dying for with this, because all we've seen is Melanie just get at Lindsay every single chance she gets. Like the slightest thing will be like, okay, you fucked Sam Auerbach. How fucking dare you? But here it's like, oh, so you are truly hurt. And so your way of showing that pain is acting as you are towards Lindsay. And there I'm like, okay, now it makes sense why it really should be Lindsay just walking away and Melanie needs to go and find a really great therapist.
I really wish we could have seen what happened to those 25 guests that came to the party. Like how did right, they exit exactly. The party? Did the party keep going or did people go, whoa, and just kind of
exactly. Like this would have been like that perfect thing where Emmett, who's so good at like sort of reading the room and being like, okay, everybody, we're just going to exit out. Like he's an event planner. He knows how to just shift the guests along.
Yeah. It's like a pub crawl. Let's take this to the next one. Let's go.
Let's go.
So this is enough that Michael and Ben are strolling through the hood. And of course there are gay couples walking through the neighborhood with their children everywhere in strollers. And Michael suddenly has this change of heart and wants to look at that house. So what really brought that on? Was it just Melanie and Lindsay splitting up and kind of breaking that nuclear family concept that said, I can fix this. All we have to do is buy this rundown house next to Eli and Monty's house and become what they aren't. Is that what we're supposed to be seeing?
That's the thing. I didn't understand where this turnabout happened. Like maybe it is what you are saying, like that he was trying to find a way to prove the cynics wrong and show how they can become that domesticated modern couple with the 2.5 children and the dog in the front yard kind of thing. I didn't understand, especially when it kind of leaves Ben with egg on his face. And he's like, nah, we decided to stay put.
By the way, we're going to look at the house.
And then Michael's like, no, you know what? We're going to look it up and we're going to buy it tomorrow. Like, what? What just happened?
I mean,
happened
I liked where it was going.
What happened to...
I liked where it was going, but I just didn't know for sure how Michael did this quick transformation. I kind of get it, but I wasn't entirely positive.
I feel like we had to stretch to really get there.
Right.
Yeah. Like, let's justify our way to get to Michael's point of view and be like, okay, that yeah, we see why he got the house. But also I can't imagine being a first, like the fact that that house is such a fixer-upper.
Oh yeah, that was a fucking dump.
Yeah, no thank you. Like I get it, like because they mentioned that what are the other couple's names again?
Eli and Monty.
Like they mentioned like how wonderful the place looks now. So clearly it was also a fixer upper and they're coming in and just doing gut rehabs all over the place.
Right.
Being a newly married couple about to buy your first house and it's going to be something like that.
Yeah. They really needed Lita to come back and do all the work on the house.
Right.
Still Queers, folks, season 5, episode 1. Stick around. Up next, Justin and Rage. So let's rewind back to the very beginning of this episode where Brian and Michael are at Babylon. This was how season 5 opened. A little bit of a preachy speech from Michael.
In here, nothing changes. Everything's the same. Same hot guys, same thumpa thumpa, same shaved chests.
And what a comfort it is to know.
But it's all a lie, an illusion, just cheap theatrics.
Nevertheless, let's keep dancing.
I've been trying to figure out how I feel about this moment. Because, you know, everything goes to the freeze frame. They're walking through it, and it almost feels very meta in a way. And I feel like the episode is opening like it's announcing, yeah, by the way, this is how the show period is going to end. Or like the show is ending. So it feels like they're now acknowledging what they've experienced over the past 5 years. I mean, does that make sense? Like, I'm like, it felt like everyone was just like waxing nostalgic.
I think this was the moment where we're told that era is over for everybody except for Brian, and everybody else has grown up and moved on. I think that's what we're supposed to see here, is that our characters are all grown up and they're going to do grown up things, and they're not going to be frivolous bar flies anymore.
And fucking everything that moves, and going to the diner and, you know, going to work within 2 hours and then going out the next night and doing the exact same thing.
And it also kind of was showing that Michael's all grown up. Brian is stagnantly still the same character that he was when the show started, except he's not. He's
exactly, yeah.
He's very different.
Oh, absolutely. Like, Brian has definitely had a character shift. And I think what's happening is that we're just acknowledging that there was this outer layer that created the lore of Brian Kenny, and that now we are actually seeing how that has been stripped away. Now, Michael doesn't see it. I think Michael still sees the shell. I think he sees the outside of it. But we as an audience definitely have seen that change in Brian.
Sure. So Justin calls Brian.
Hey, dickhead, turn off your fucking cell phone.
Good boy.
What's up?
Just lying here, eating a bag of Doritos, reading The Brothers Karamazov. What about you?
Anna Karenina and Pringles.
I always said it was our love of Russian literature and snacks, high in saturated fat, that brought us together.
So how's work?
Up to my ass in storyboards. But Brett is thrilled. He says he never could have envisioned the project without me. He's even talking about a sequel.
My superhero.
Only trouble is pre-production's slower than we expected, so I might have to stay longer than I thought.
How much longer?
Another 3 months, maybe 4.
I thought it was funny that apparently cell phone calls aren't allowed in the back room of Babylon. Somebody yells at Brian to turn off his cell phone. What? Who cares?
I mean, right? Well, maybe it was like a focus thing. Like, you know, like a guy who's like, he's in it. You know, he's about to come. And then a phone ring goes off. And you're like, what the fuck? You just broke my concentration. Maybe that's what it was.
What was
but
this,
I also love the fact we also got the return of Todd. And I loved
Todd,
that.
Yeah, he's in every season premiere. We used to end every podcast episode with Todd. It's just kind of weird, though. So I stopped doing that. What was this party that Justin was at in Hollywood? Everyone was naked, but the sun didn't even seem to be out. And why wasn't Justin naked at this party? He had a towel.
Right, he was wearing a towel. I didn't understand. Yeah, this was some sort of Hollywood, maybe it was at Bryan Singer's house, where, yeah, just guys were naked, fucking, doing whatever, hanging out. And I what I loved about this scene, it almost felt like an evolved season 1 scene, where like there was definitely like graphic nudity, but almost like a sly bit of humor, and that they're having this like rather honest and kind of a grounded conversation while one is getting blown in the back room and the other one is hanging out at a Hollywood pool party. But like they're talking to each other and they seem still very like they're not fazed by what is going on around them.
Oh, this scene got me thinking about why it's such a big deal that Justin is staying in Hollywood for an extra 3 months, because Brian has enough money to buy a nightclub. So what's stopping him from flying out to Hollywood every other weekend to see Justin? It's played off as if Justin moved to Mars or something.
Yeah, that's almost impossible for him to get there. Like, and then he even makes the point of like, when are you going to come visit me? And yet we know that Brian can easily make that move to like see him. And he also has Ted, who is effectively running Kinetic. So why doesn't he just go out to Hollywood too?
He was going to. Brian cancels his trip, but I don't know why he canceled the trip. Was that clear to you?
No. I remember seeing that moment. It's the moment right before we see Ted and in his rotund fashion. And we see him like checking the tickets. I thought he was getting ready to leave to the airport.
So the only reason why he didn't go was because Justin was going to stay longer?
Which doesn't make any sense because, I mean, he is making a movie.
That could go on forever, right?
It's rare that movies ever get really delivered on time, especially when it's supposed to be some big blockbuster superhero movie. You know, I was also having trouble trying to figure out why he was like, you know what? No, I'm not going to go.
Speaking of those storyboard bumpers that were in there with like the rage kind of narration mm-hmm. throughout the whole thing, I didn't mind them. It's gimmicky, but I liked it.
I was a big
fan. It worked.
Oh, yeah. No, I was a big fan of it. Mainly because, one, it's a great little style that we haven't seen before in the show. And two, I think it also, I mean, it was clearly very much influenced by what the 2004 Hulk movie did. So just to catch you up, we've had three different people within the 2000s play the Incredible Hulk. Mark Ruffalo has been doing it for all the recent stuff. There was Ed Norton who did it in like a sort of a reboot of what Ang Lee directed in 2004. So right before this episode aired. And in Ang Lee's Hulk, the movie was showered with that stuff where he treated it like you were watching a comic book come to life. And there were a lot of edits and cuts that used comic book panels to move us in and out of scenes and transitions. So I think that's where they definitely got their.
So you're saying it was a ripoff?
It kind of was. But it's a really great way to it's a smart thing to use, especially in this episode where rage has such a prominent place in the story. With, you know, Justin being out in the, you know, working in the art department and, you know, creating all these scenes, and we have the Rage movie still being made, and then how to edit it back into what's going on in Pittsburgh. So I really liked it. I really liked it too.
Speaking of ripoffs, did you notice the walk and talks in this episode? It was like right out of the West Wing.
With like a third of the good writing. like the writing in West Wing is like impeccable. Where you don't realize you just got a shit ton of information while people were going from here to here within the White House.
I thought this exterior scene was pretty well done, though. And so nice work, Kelly Macon.
Yes.
Brian's narration was intercut with Justin getting pounded by Connor. I love that.
One project turns into another and another before you know it. He's there a year, 5 years. It's the way it goes. I mean, I don't blame him. He's having the time of his life, working in the movies. It's fucking movie stars. It's time he got on with his life. It's the time I got on with mine.
Whew. What do you think of Brian saying that Justin won't be coming back? I found it believable. Justin could surely have a career in Hollywood. What I didn't really care for is that Brian was writing him off so quickly just after inviting him to move in with him. That didn't seem to quite track with the story. I would have liked to have seen Brian miss Justin a little bit longer than 5 minutes.
Yeah, that I picked up on that too, because I felt like with that intercut of rage fucking Justin, that it felt like Brian was resigned to the idea that the relationship has run its course in some way.
But why?
Now he's out in Hollywood. He's so? Doing what he should be doing. That's it for me. I was like, but
yeah, I have no options. I have no ability to
to possibly join him out there.
Yeah.
Like, yes, of course he's, you know, getting fucked by a movie, like he's fucking movie stars. But I'd be like, yeah, but also you're getting blown in the back room of Babylon, what makes you think you can't be fucking movie stars too?
And plus, Brian is portrayed as, at this point in his career, as being very wealthy. That gives him the ability to do pretty much anything that he'd want to do. So like, what's stopping him?
Brian, like, is Brian worried that he's spent so long being kind of like the big fish in a little pond that when he goes to the big pond, that is Hollywood, that he'll like not be as big of a deal? Like I didn't quite get it.
Yeah, maybe he thinks he can't compete with Connor for Justin's attention.
I think he can compete with Connor because Connor's eyebrows kind of drove me nuts.
So Babylon is shut down again.
May I have your attention? Oh, man. This club is officially closed. So pull up your pants and go home.
Let's go, come on. Come on. That's my shirt. Let's go, everybody. Rackman. Party's over, let's go.
That includes you. Just wait a second.
Don't give me any lift.
Grab my shirt. Just grab the t-shirt.
Let's go.
Go.
Yeah,
you have a good night. Thanks, officer. Do the same for you one day.
How many times has this club been shut down in the middle of the night where the police come in and shut it down?
Like what? Three, four times now. Like, why is it in the middle of the night?
Right. Police burst in, and it was kind of a dumb gag with Brian finishing so dramatically in front of the cop. And it was just a little too long to be plausible. It would have been better if the lights came on and he was like, but it's like, oh, officer, wait for me.
Right. And it would have been funny if he was like, hold on. He's still going. He's still going as the lights came up or something like that. I don't know. But like, it's...
Yeah,
I don't get that. I also have trouble with the way this show, because I also noticed it when I think we'll talk about it in the next episode, when characters are giving blowjobs, it looks like they're doing everything but actually sucking the dick. They're going all the way around it. But even here, like, I could barely tell that the guy is actually going down on a dick.
I didn't notice this.
It drives me nuts. The show actually does it a lot. And I think this episode just kind of like hit me to the breaking point because now we're seeing it in like full terrible, you know. Wait,
you hit the lighting. Breaking point because the blowjob scenes weren't realistic enough?
Like, come on. Give me something here. Like, clearly they had enough gay people working on it where I felt someone would have been like, hi, excuse me, that's not how that works. Let me demonstrate.
I'm going to have to look at this scene again.
Yeah. Finally, I finally have had it.
Well, just like Brian's blowjob, Rage is shut down. And just like that, Rage is over, I guess. We never see Justin again for the rest of this episode either.
Okay, superhero, turn in your tights. Fenderman just pulled the plug.
What? He can't do that.
He can, and he did. He's reamed my ass. And not like in scene 32 where Rage gives JT the rimming of a lifetime. Well, the picture's over budget, over schedule.
You said they say that about every picture.
They do.
Then what's the real reason?
He's afraid. The times, the political climate.
Well, he's wrong. Tell him there are millions of queers out there with billions of dollars.
I did. He's more concerned about alienating the family audience, pissing off the parent corporation, displeasing someone in Washington who can make that tax break very hard to come by.
What, so it's over? Just like that?
He's greenlighting the Passion of Moses. Gaze out. God's in.
Yeah, and also I need to talk about the Rage costume.
Oh,
because
yeah.
Because that looked like a cheap piece of tinfoil. This is some big Hollywood movie. It would have looked a lot better than that. And they were also like complimenting his package in it. I was like, come on.
Was that a real package or are we led to believe that it was like a stunt package, like a Dirk Diggler package?
That was definitely not a Dirk Diggler package.
But Justin made a comment about it. I wonder what we were supposed to think there.
Exactly. Like, yeah, he made it seem like, whoa. And I was like, really though? Like, you're impressed by that?
So we have to talk about a scene that was just off the rails and batshit crazy. That's Brian Baez's nightclub. And if you ever doubted that Queer as Folk had jumped the shark by now, it was this scene where Brian is climbing around on the catwalks, yelling and screaming.
And what would be practical, Theodore?
To get married and move to the suburbs and become a home-loving, child-raising, God-fearing, imitation heterosexual? And for what? so that I can become another dead soul going to the mall and dropping my kids off at school and having barbecues in the backyard. Oh, that's their death. Not mine. I'm a cocksucker! I'm queer! And to anyone who takes pity or offense, I say, judge yourself. This is where I live. This is who I am.
It was just ridiculous. Where like was this coming from?
Like it was some act of queer defiance. So he's going to buy the club and he's going to bring Babylon back. And I'm like, we know that there are multiple bars. We know that there are multiple bars on Liberty Avenue. Everyone will just go to the next one. Maybe within the next few years, someone will buy Babylon. They'll rebrand it and it'll come up with something different. So what bugged me about this is that he buys it, but he doesn't really do anything with it.
Well, that was funny too, because Ted is saying we have to hire the go-go boys and the bartenders and the door staff, et cetera. What happened to the people that used to work there? Surely they would like their job back, right?
Exactly. I'm making it sound like they got to start from scratch. Other than the previous owner who was clearly like doing some illegal things, the poor staff didn't have anything to do with it. Probably,
right.
Maybe we don't. Maybe they were. Maybe it was a whole ring. Maybe it was a whole crime ring.
It's like, call them up. Come back on Friday. We're opening. They'd be like, yeah, you got it.
New management. Done.
Right.
Like, come on.
I think that Brian could have bought the bar and left off this scene where he's screaming and yelling to no one in particular. It's like, yeah, we know who you are, Brian. We've been with you for 5 years. We know what you're about. Why are you screaming and yelling?
Right. Because then it felt, again, like it's so much less about Babylon and what it means to the community and more about just Brian's ego and making sure that people know that he's still around. He still matters.
We'll be back with more Still Queer as Folk. So our first runner of the night, I'll call Debbie's house. This could have been a sitcom premise all in itself.
Yes, where's the Family Matters like title card?
I mean, we've talked about this a lot, that there's so much good material in some of these characters that's unexplored, that there could have been all these other spinoffs of it. Like Daphne, the college years, would have been a good one. And Debbie's house would have been great because so many people have moved in and out of this house and there's been so much going on there. But we find out that Debbie had moved in with Carl. Did we know that?
Or she was in the process. She was in the process of moving in with Carl.
It seemed like she had set up shop there and was only going back to her house every now and again to get a few things. We don't know what her long-term plan was for that house, though. Was she just going to keep it for Emmett?
I mean, maybe. But that's the thing. Because Horvath even says, like, we've had numerous conversations about you coming over here and how the house is full of bad memories and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, but if you've had these continuous conversations, like, why aren't we seeing like a for sale sign in the law and, you know, in the lawn or something? Yeah, it didn't quite track.
We also never got to see them in Carl's pad. I would love to see Carl's house. I just think that'd be really interesting. Like that first time that we saw Daphne's bedroom and I dissected all the posters on her wall to like really understand the backstory behind Daphne. I would have liked to have done that with Carl's house.
But like, what's funny to me is that when we're told that she's living with her, I don't know why, but I have trouble believing he lives in a house. For some reason, I see it as some sort of bachelor pad apartment for an older gentleman. Like, I don't know why. I had trouble believing it was a house. Clearly, it has to be a house because he's a detective.
Well, so, he used to have a wife that died, too. So presumably, they had a house that was their marital home or something like that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, logically, it makes sense he has a house. But in my head, for some reason, it's some apartment that's clearly a man lives there kind of thing.
It never seemed really at all in play that Debbie would live or could live anywhere else, but I still like the way that she described her house.
I've lived in this house almost 30 years. It's practically all of Michael's life. There were days when we could barely muster up the mortgage, and days when we partied all night long, and that didn't even count, birthdays and holidays. This house is a part of me. And I've never been away from it until now.
It's always been a focal point of the show. A lot of action has been stitched together in that house. And so it was almost a little unbelievable that she would ever leave it.
Well, again, and that feeds into what I was talking about earlier about how this episode feels like how it's the beginning of the end, where it feels like everyone is, you know,
moving on,
talking about all the times we had in this place and
all
that's happened. Yeah.
Carl and Debbie, in order to get Debbie's lasagna pan, go back to the house and walk in on Emmett just getting plowed in quite an acrobatic position, I might add.
Find me like you mean it. Come on.
Welcome home.
Yeah, he's telling this guy, Sean, to fuck him like he means it.
There's really only one way to fuck somebody, and that's it.
If you like, you mean it.
Debbie summed it up really nicely with, "Welcome home." That was great. I love that line. Because Debbie's like, "Yeah, this goes on," and Carl's like,
ugh. "Right, yeah." Carl is aghast, but for Deb, she probably would have been like, and just walked up the stairs, you know?
Right. Or she would have made a pithy comment like, "Hey, remember to use protection, guys."
Yeah.
Like the time she was walking through Brian's orgy.
You need anything? Snacks? Condoms? Oh, God love you.
It makes sense that Emmett would want to get his own place. I always found it a little bit weird that Emmett was rooming with a middle-aged woman. A short-term arrangement would have been great because Justin used to do that. Justin used to live with Debbie. But in early 30s, Emmett surely would want a place of his own by now, right? I mean, he's a successful event planner who has sex with NFL football players. So what's he still doing there?
He has to have something in the bank that would allow, say, a down payment or would easily be able to pay the rent. Like, I see him on par with what Brian is doing. Mm. He's his own business and successful.
Well, he runs into Carl in the kitchen in underwear. First thing, though, I hated Emmett's underwear. We've seen him in briefs before, like when he was a porn star. This pair of trunks were not cute.
Now, did you find like the cut of it not cute, or was it the multicolor?
Yes. The cut was not cute. It did not accentuate Emmett's parts. And I don't know what was going on with that color. That was just
it felt very early 90s Almodovar kind of thing. Yeah.
I did like the awkward moment, though, and I thought it was good treatment for a conversation between Carl and Emmett that may very well could have been taking place elsewhere or anywhere for that matter. But I like that Cohen and Lippman put the characters into a moment of vulnerability first before they had that conversation. The weird thing was, like, who's going to eat, like, chicken wings at 3 a.m? You'll get heartburn.
An early 30s person could still do it. Well, I can't speak for that, even though I am in early 30s. No, I would be concerned. I can't. No, thank you. But no, I agree. I found that scene really lovely. And I like how he says, you know, that he's, you know, how Emmett compliments Carl and that he's quite a man.
So I think the purpose of this scene was to tell us that Emmett, Carl, and Debbie are going to continue living together next.
Really?
Did this really even need a scene?
Well, that's the thing. It was a lovely moment.
Yeah.
I guess so Horvath could get used to, like, this is kind of what you're going to see. And it was nice to see that he didn't back away in fear of what he might see. He might see another man naked. He might see two men naked who are inside another man, kind of thing.
Our last runner of the night, I'm just going to say, is called Ted is Hungry. This was one crazy ass story. The sight gags were like way over the top. They managed to add like 50 pounds to Ted in both padding underneath his costumes and makeup. And he's eating in every single scene that he's in. It was kind of like Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11, where he always has food in his hands and he's always eating. Ted's eating throughout this entire episode. But where did this come from? When did he get so hungry?
So first off, Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11 always eating is my favorite Brad Pitt. Second.
Because of the food? Agree. Or
the whole package was mwah. Big fan. But no, I agree. Like, it felt like there were so many like 90s and early 2000s shows that would always end up doing a show or a storyline about a character gaining a lot of weight. Like, I mean, I can tell you, like, it happened in Frasier, mainly because the actress who played Daphne was pregnant. So they hit it using a really sort of insensitive storyline about how she's gaining weight and they send her to a fat farm.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's rewatching it and you're like, oh, that is not a great thing that happens. Because, like, the amount of comments they have about her weight is insanity. You know, like you find where like and it becomes like a punchline of sorts, and that's sort of what and then that's sort of what happens here. Or I think I was more afraid of that's what was going to happen, but instead we have like this moment where, oh my God, we're at the social gym.
Social gym is back,
and they, you know, both Emmett and Brian sort of from different tactics try to point out that Ted has clearly gained weight.
Look, I know you don't want to hear this, so please, please promise me you won't take it the wrong way. But as your friend, I feel it's my obligation to tell you, you're getting a little,
A little what?
A little hearty. Robust. I mean,
fat.
Yeah, I can't imagine, like, friends saying that to each other.
At least in that manner. Like, it's not even where it's like, oh, he has clearly gone off the deep end of unhealthy. I mean, yes, he's gained a little weight. That happens. That's a thing. Like, that's okay. And I like that he has a point of saying that when he was super skinny, it reminds him of when he, you know, was on Crystal, and that was not a good moment for him, and that he is now just, that is a shadow of his former self, and he feels confident in his body, and blah, blah. And I really love that he had that speech. I was like, oh, okay. Maybe this isn't going where I thought it was going to go, where he's just going to be the punching bag of the episode because he's put on a little weight. And then, you know, we see some guy has cruised him in the gym. So he goes up and speaks to him. And we're like, okay. And like, even then I was like waiting on the guy to say like, oh no, I was looking at him. Or like, I was waiting for the guy like, hi, I'm a personal trainer. So like, let me know if I can help you out, lose those few extra pounds. Like I was waiting on that interaction and then it didn't happen.
Well, one note that I had is okay, so this character, does he even have a name? Do we ever know this guy's name?
No, I think they only describe him as his new boyfriend or something like that. Yeah.
So it's one thing if he likes heavy guys, that's fair. But is going to the gym the place that he wants to find them? The second part is, what is this like force feeding of Ted to turn somebody into a body type that they're into? Like, yes. Okay. If you like heavy guys, great. Are you going to try to make one?
It comes down to, I mean, it is a fetish for sure, where there are those who, I hate using this phrase, but it's probably the best phrase to use. He's a chubby chaser.
They use the phrase.
Okay. They use
maybe in the next episode, but those words came out of Ted's mouth.
I'm also just not a fan of it, but you know, there are those who fetishize food and the use of food in erotic situations.
Really?
I mean, oh yeah. I even talked to a guy for a little bit who would like talk about like when he would eat and he would eat something that was like unhealthy and how like bloated it made him feel or stuff like that. And that like got him hot. It was very interesting.
But wait, but he was doing that himself though, right?
Yes. But also he would tell me how he was attracted to guys who were heavier, who had a belly, who had, you know, that kind of stuff.
I think is fine, but I don't think that people like try to turn people into that though, right? They try to find somebody that matches what they're into. This guy was just like shoving pizza down Ted's mouth. Okay, you've got promise. Let me feed you an entire pizza. And yeah, exactly. This one pizza will help.
He wanted him bigger. I mean, this is the thing. Like, even on a
well, why did Ted's? Why did Ted draws attention in the first place.
It's probably because he saw potential in him.
So he's a project?
I mean, maybe. He's like, oh, you know what? Maybe if you eat a little more, you'll get a little bigger. You know, like,
yeah, but that takes time. So. That's like an investment.
Well, that's the thing. Like, people, it's one of those things, like, people can gain weight very easily and lose it really, like, in a, it takes forever to lose it. Easy to gain, hard to lose.
You can't gain like 20 pounds, though, in like a night or a week.
Well, no, not like that. But here he's like, he wants to make sure he is well fed. I mean, it's all part of that fetish and how like the food plays into it. And
this just seemed like a scene from Seven where John Doe was force feeding the guy pasta for the gluttony sin.
Oh, the glutton?
Yeah. I just didn't get this.
I mean, I don't get either. I try not to yuck anyone's yum, but my other thing is that it's when it becomes a fetish where like the other person's not really in on it, that's where it really becomes a problem.
Right.
That's the thing, is that Ted was not sort of willingly doing this. And that's where it's like, wait a minute, what's going on?
Okay, let's talk tops and bottoms for this episode. Okay. What was your top?
My top, I had a couple. I really enjoyed the comic strip framing. I thought it was actually really fun and really well used throughout the series or throughout the episode. It didn't feel like it was forced anywhere. They used it like sparingly, but effectively. My other top would definitely be that conversation that Emmett has with Horvath. That really shows that Emmett is, of all the characters in the show, clearly the most well-adjusted. Like, yes, he can get fucked in the living room when he thinks no one's coming home, but he is also successful and he is a great friend and he can be there for his friends when he needs to. He can also give the tough love. Like, he can do so much for people. And I also like, he understands, like, the reason why he wants to move out is that while Debbie was like hesitant about it or didn't understand why he wanted to move out, he's like, you need to have your own life and I do too. And that's okay. We can do that. You should be with your man, kind of thing. So like, I love that for Emmett. And I love that the show has shown how he can be that person.
So my top was the big Melanie and Lindsay reveal. I've been waiting for this for many episodes, and the payoff was really, really well executed. I love that awkwardness of all of this stuff just comes spewing out in front of people. I wouldn't have done a thing differently with that scene, and that's unusual for me to say about this show. Even given some of the goofy bits surrounding it and some of the implausibility of it, I thought the execution of it was really well. So that was my top. What was your bottom?
So I know that was a top for you. My bottom is really Melanie continuing to use Lindsay as her personal punching bag. I sort of kind of like hit my end with it, especially when she decides to do it at the party in front of 25 guests and her friends. And, you know, it's like that was absolutely not the place to do that and absolutely highly unnecessary. And you're only doing that to make yourself look better and make Lindsay look like trash.
So my bottom was Ted's quote chubby chaser quote story. I know where this is headed because I've watched a couple episodes ahead, but used as comedy, this just doesn't hold up these days. And it's not, I just didn't even find it realistic that this guy would be force feeding Ted so much and Ted would just be going along with it. So I just thought this story didn't need to be there, or they could have executed it a little bit differently. Like, yes, Ted wants to change his image. It doesn't have to be this moment of where other people are trying to recreate him into something that doesn't match what he sees himself as. So that was my bottom. This has been episode 1 of season 5. Next time on Still Queer as Folk, Justin returns to Pittsburgh to find that Brian bought Babylon. Everyone, even remotely connected to Melanie and Michael's child, lawyers up and a wild custody battle ensues. Emmett is invited to guest host a TV show, which is a blatant ripoff of a real-world show called Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
If you like what you heard today, a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us would be much appreciated. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF and on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk is a production of Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me tonight. New episodes every other week for season 5. Still Queer as Folk was made with love in Chicago.